Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, October 22nd, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor and chief film critic, Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, Chris, let's talk about some movie and TV news today. So first up, something that I know that you're probably tracking very closely. You're subscribed to all of his alerts on Threads, I'm sure. James Gunn has given another update about the Superman movie that he's making that's coming out next year. And, you know, we joke because James Gunn is just seemingly constantly providing updates on everything that he's doing and really just being capital O online and weighing in on just about everything these days. But I was curious because the most recent update we have is that he shared this look at Superman's dog, Crypto, who is going to be in this movie. And as a dog lover, I just wondered if this changed your anticipation level at all for this film.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious to see this. I'm curious to see James Gunn's take on Superman. And I like dogs, and I like that he's trying something different. Like, you know, there hasn't been a Superman movie where Superman has Crypto the dog. And of course, I saw that people online were like complaining because Jesus Christ, what a miserable world we've built for ourselves, where people are just like, they're angry that the dog doesn't look the same as it looks in the comics. And it's like, you know what? Just stop. Just like, good Lord. Like, can we please calm down? Like, good. I don't know. I, for one, am looking forward to a Superman movie where he has a super dog. Let's do that. Let's have some fun.
Yeah, I'm really hoping the dog blasts lasers out of its eyes and all that kind of stuff as well. So, yeah, regardless, I think it just goes to show yet again that he is really sort of doing something totally different than what we've seen before. You know, it's been, like you said, we've never seen Crypto in live action, at least as far as I know. I mean, maybe in like some sort of deep background Easter egg in one of the movies or something, but not as a primary character or whatever. So I'm curious to see what happens. Okay, so like the main news really that I think we should be talking about is something that broke last night, which is that our old pal Jermaine Lussier over at IO9 and Gizmodo reported last night this rumor about Christopher Nolan's next movie. So I think what we know is that Christopher Nolan is going to be making a film. I believe it's coming out in 2026, and it stars Matt Damon and Tom Holland. That is like official news that's come out in the trades over the past week or so. And so Jermaine, who used to write for Slash Film, if people don't recognize his name, he reported this rumor last night saying that he thinks that he's heard from his sources or whatever that the movie is going to be a vampire period piece from Christopher Nolan, which is just kind of incredible if that's actually true. So what's your like gut reaction to that, Chris?
You know, I don't want to call anyone a liar, but I don't believe this is accurate. I don't want to use sources for that, but it just seems wrong. I can't imagine Christopher Nolan doing a vampire movie. It just does not seem something he'd be interested in. Like, I can see him doing a horror movie, but I can't see him doing a vampire movie. But you know, I'll absolutely watch it if it happens, and I'm not against the idea at all, but I just don't, something about this does not seem right to me. It just seems inaccurate.
Yeah, this is definitely a not fully confirmed type of thing, but I thought it was interesting to talk about. And the reason that I think this might actually be true is that vampires are immortal, and so that would fit in with Nolan's obsession with time. So that could technically maybe explain his interest in this subject. But BJ wrote the article for us last night, and she made some great points in this piece. She pointed out that vampires are often highly emotional, while Nolan's characters are typically more philosophical or like analytical. And she also says that there's an inherent queerness to vampires, which is not something that Nolan has really delved into as a storyteller. So it does seem maybe a little outside of his wheelhouse when you bring in and factor in all the lore of vampires and what that could mean. If this is true, though, it would be really interesting because that would mean that both Christopher Nolan and Ryan Coogler, two of like the biggest studio filmmakers in Hollywood, are directing vampire period pieces basically around the same time. So just a really interesting coincidence if that ends up being true. So we'll be keeping a close eye on this. I just wanted to kind of do a temperature check with you there on that one, Chris. All right, let's talk about Stephen King, which is one of your favorite subjects. So Paul Greengrass, who directed several of the Bourne movies, wrote an adaptation of Stephen King's 2022 novel Fairy Tale that he was going to direct as a movie for Universal. And what happened recently is that Universal ended up letting the project go, and now A24 has decided to turn it into a 10-episode TV show instead. Paul Greengrass is going to be expanding that movie script into 10 TV scripts with somebody named J.H. Wyman, who worked on sci-fi shows like Fringe and Almost Human, and Wyman is going to be the showrunner for this project. And then Paul Greengrass is still involved not only as a writer, but as an executive producer, and he also could still direct some episodes, although his deal is evidently not done for that just yet. So, Chris, have you read Fairy Tale, and what do you think about Paul Greengrass being involved on the creative end of things here?
Yeah, I have read it. I don't think he's the right person to do this. I mean, I guess since he's not directing it all, it's different now. So, but he does not seem like the right person for this material. My knee-jerk reaction to this is like, this is a bad idea because it's obvious they're going to... I don't want to get off on like a tangent here, but I have this real problem with modern TV in that everyone keeps approaching their shows as like 10-hour movies, and I don't want to see that. I've talked about this before. I don't want a 10-hour movie. I want a TV show when I'm watching TV. We've lost that episodic thing, and like they're just gonna make this a 10-hour movie, and I like just keep it as an actual movie. Like, you know, there's
well, did you ever see? Did you ever watch Fringe when that was on?
I did not. No.
I watched a couple, maybe like one season, a handful of episodes anyway, and that was a very episodic show, and I have not seen Almost Human, but I understand that that's how that show is as well. So maybe the fact that J.H. Wyman is going to be sort of the main creative force here as the showrunner of this thing might potentially speak highly of the maybe a different approach than what you're talking about. Like maybe they could actually bring it back to that sort of classical, more traditional TV storytelling with like good bones, legitimate episodes that have beginning, middle, and ends and arcs and stuff like that, and just like an overarching narrative that goes throughout the season or something, as opposed to that splitting it up into just 10 chunks kind of thing that you're talking about. So
yeah.
Wyman's involvement has me wondering if maybe they brought somebody like that on because he has that history of making like actually episodic episodes of TV. So I don't know, maybe, fingers crossed, we'll see what happens. But I was wondering, like, people can read the synopsis of what this story is actually about in our article, the book Fairy Tale that Stephen King wrote, but Deadline says that this is King's first real foray into fantasy. Do you think that's true? Do you agree with that?
That is not true. First of all, the Dark Tower series is very steeped in fantasy. Mm. And then in 1984, he published a book called The Eyes of the Dragon, which is a full-blown fantasy epic with knights and dragons and all that stuff. So
wow, okay,
incorrect statement right there.
There was something about, I don't know, for some reason that sentence just jumped out at me when I was reading the Deadline article, and I was like, I don't know, I gotta ask Chris about this, because I knew that you were probably more knowledgeable about Stephen King's work than whatever dashed off article was up on Deadline. So
whatever AI they use to write their article.
I mean, no, I'm not gonna cast aspersions at Mike Fleming Jr. that he's using AI, but you know,
it's parody. This was a parody statement. I can get away with saying whatever I want if I say it's parody.
Sometimes it does feel like Deadline just basically like regurgitates press releases or whatever. So maybe that was something that was written somewhere else and they just didn't really fact check it or whatever. Anyway, let's talk about another Stephen King project, which is that our old pal Mike Flanagan, who is a frequent adapter of King's work, is now going to be working on Carrie as a TV show for Prime Video. So I assume you have some thoughts about this, Chris. Like I saw the original Carrie a long time ago. This is not really a story that I have revisited a lot over the years. I've never read the book. What do you think about turning Carrie into what I believe is going to be lined up as an 8-episode show?
Yeah, you know, again, I have that same hesitation where I'm worried this is going to be an 8-hour movie. But the fact that Flanagan is involved sort of gives me a touch of optimism, because for one thing, he's very good at adapting Stephen King stuff. And for another thing, he sort of has a knack, but he does this thing where he can take source material and change it to fit a TV show. Like, I love the Haunting of Hill House Netflix series. but that series is absolutely nothing like Shirley Jackson's book. And Shirley Jackson's book is a masterpiece. It's one of the best horror books ever written. But Flanagan's take on it is incredibly different than the book, but it works. It works really well. And he sort of did a similar thing with the House of Usher series that came out, I think, last year, mm-hmm. where that doesn't just take the House of Usher story. It takes a bunch of Edgar Allan Poe stories and works them into this TV series. So I'm very curious to see if he's going to sort of take a similar approach to Carrie, where he's not really adapting the book. He's sort of taking the bones of the book and making something different out of it. So yeah, that I'd be curious to see what he does, because, and honestly, I'd rather he do something like that, because a few minor issues, a few things that are changed aside, Ryan De Palma's movie adaptation is pretty much a perfect adaptation of the book. And it's been adapted again and again. You know, there was the Chloe Grace Moretz remake. Interesting enough, there was a TV movie version of Carrie, which was supposed to be a pilot for a TV series where, like, Carrie goes on a bunch of adventures and stuff like that. Like, wow. I think it's not a spoiler to say everyone knows how Carrie ends, where Carrie kills everyone at the prom and then Carrie dies herself. But at the end of the TV movie, Carrie survives and she, like, gets on a bus and leaves town. And that was because it was supposed to be a pilot to set up that, like, Carrie moves somewhere else and other stuff happens to her, but it never got picked up to series. So, yeah.
But basically, like, all of the events from the book or from that first movie are condensed into that one pilot episode?
Yeah, pretty much. It's feature length, because they made it like a feature, like, it was like a pilot movie that was supposed to, you know. So, I am very curious to see what he does here and how it's adapted. Like I said, I really do hope they take the approach where they just change things up, because, you know, what else is there to say at this point of just, like, telling the same story over and over again?
Yeah. Do you think that a modernized, I actually didn't see that 2013 version of Carrie. Did that version include, like, social media bullying and stuff like that? Right. Like, that's the kind of thing that I would imagine a modern version of Carrie would include. Do you know if that movie tapped into that at all?
I can't remember it off the top of my head, honestly. I don't think it really updated much. There definitely is room to update Carrie, you know, in this modern age of bullying, where bullying has gone, you know, online and, you know, it become more prominent. And it's also, like, you know, it's Carrie was written before the age of, you know, where like school shootings have become sort of like, for lack of a better term, our norm, this horrible norm where students lash out against other students, stuff like that. So there is room to do something with that. It really depends on how delicate you want to handle that sort of heavy subject matter and stuff like that. But there's definitely sort of room to bring this into, like, the modern age. So I guess I am curious to see how they handle that sort of thing.
Yeah, Mike Flanagan is really, really busy right now. He has The Life of Chuck, which is a non-Horror King adaptation that's coming out next year that's already done. He's also working on The Dark Tower, and he's doing a new Exorcist movie. So that's all in addition to getting this Carrie show off the ground. So I wonder how much he's actually going to be involved, if he's just going to write all the episodes, if he's going to be directing them. I think you have, like, you've said before that there's, like, a pretty extremely mixed track record when it comes to Flanagan shows where he doesn't direct all the episodes. So
We'll see. I think so, yeah.
We'll see how that goes. But all right, let's take a break and then we'll come back and talk about some more movie news. All right, so Denis Villeneuve, the director of the most recent Dune movies, has basically given us a little bit of a hint that Dune 3, or I think basically it's just being called Dune 3 right now. He's going to be adapting Dune Messiah, which is the second book in Frank Herbert's Dune lore, I guess, Dune series. Anyway, Dune 3 has been rumored and talked about ever since the second movie came out. There was a little bit of a, I guess, like a potential break that Villeneuve was going to be taking, because there's supposed to be something like 11 or 12 years story-wise between the end of what we saw in Dune Part 2 and when Dune Part 3 picks up. So I think a lot of people were wondering if he was going to be able to maybe make one or two more movies and then return to Dune 3. But it sounds like Legendary and the folks who are going to be making and releasing this movie want to really light the fire under this and capitalize on Dune fever, get this out as quickly as possible. So he said in a recent interview with Deadline that he's going to, quote, go back behind the camera faster than I think to make this third movie. He says he's in the writing zone right now. Production could start in 2026, and this will, quote, finish the Paul Atreides arc. So I think Warner Brothers currently has a Denis Villeneuve event film scheduled on the calendar for December 18th, 2026. So it'll be really interesting to see if he's able to turn this around really quickly and make that date with Dune 3, or if maybe he's going to be able to sneak in that adaptation of Annie Jacobson's book, Nuclear War, a scenario first. But what do you make this, Chris? Are you like excited to see Dune 3? Do you wish that he would take whatever, 3 or 4 years off and then return to this world? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I kind of would like him to do other stuff. I kind of just don't want him to just keep churning out Dune movies. You know, I like the Dune movies, but I'm not like, I need more of these. You know, I need another Dune movie. Like, I would be fine waiting a while for another Dune movie. But
yeah
I'd kind of rather him do something like different, because I think he's an interesting filmmaker and I want to see him do things outside of the Dune universe.
Yeah. I wonder what this is going to do for his career. Like, if the idea of him jumping back into this movie quickly might actually be good for him in the long run, because then it's not this sort of thing that's dangling over him as like, oh my God, I've got to finish off this Dune trilogy, it's going to be such an undertaking or whatever. Maybe the idea that he can just sort of knock it out quickly or relatively quickly will let him sort of close the door on that chapter of this storytelling that he's doing. And maybe he'll be able to use the juice that he earns from making those and put that into something. Yeah. Maybe more, I don't know, just different, I guess is the word. Cause it's not like these movies aren't personal or really interesting or great. So I'm excited that he's making them, but I don't want to see him get sucked into and trapped in that world. But it sounds like this third movie is going to be the last one that he's going to be doing. So I did want to ask you, Chris, about Christian Bale's American Psycho, that this really famous movie from 2000, Mary Harron directed this film. Christian Bale played Patrick Bateman. And this movie is getting a new adaptation from director Luca Guadagnino, the Italian director behind the remake of Suspiria and Bones and All and Challengers from earlier this year. So what do you make of this pairing of this director and this subject matter of Bret Easton Ellis's novel of American Psycho?
I think this is good. I actually think this is a really interesting combination. Scott Z. Burns is writing the script and he's a really good screenwriter. I love the Mary Harron take on American Psycho, but it's a lot different than the book. In a lot of ways, it's almost like a parody of the book. It's almost like, look at how stupid this book is. Let's make fun of it. And I do think there's an interesting way to sort of like adapt the book to be more accurate. And I don't just mean in terms of like, you know, the book is famous for having really graphic violence. And I'm not saying like they need to do that. I just mean like a more sort of accurate take on the book would kind of be interesting to me. I kind of would like to see that. And I think this is a really cool pairing of material. So I'm actually very curious to see how this turns out.
So do you have any casting wish list choices or anything? Was there anybody when you read this news that immediately jumped to mind of like, oh man, this person would be perfect for the Patrick Bateman of today?
Now, all I can say is every fan casting I'm seeing of this is terrible and wrong. People seem to think, like, I once saw an actor wear a suit, and that means they should play Patrick Bateman. It's like, this is exhausting. Stop it. I'm also seeing a lot of, like, gender flipped where it's like, they should cast a woman. And it's like, that really misinterprets the character. The character is, like, a misogynistic idiot guy that's kind of, like, essential to the character. And being like, I saw a woman wear a suit once. She should play Patrick Bateman. It's like, no, like you don't understand this material. Like, I don't know how else to put it. So I'm willing to be pleasantly surprised here, and rather than sort of like fan cast it.
Okay, so we have our own fan casting article up on slashfilm.com that I'll link to in the show notes. Thankfully, it's a little bit more detailed than just this person wore a suit one time. So I'll link to that if you're interested in some of the suggestions that we have there. Last question about this, Chris, is it's been a long time since I've seen this movie. It kind of seems to me like the 1980s setting of American Psycho, where, you know, it's very like Wall Street bro, you know, that whole kind of yuppie vibe is pretty crucial to my understanding of what that story is. I wonder if you think that there's room for updating the setting of this movie to be about whatever, crypto bros, or like any other number of like more modern things, or if you think that Guadagnino might actually keep this set in the 1980s.
I really hope he keeps it set in the 80s. That's sort of like essential to the story. It's very much a book about the 80s and that era. And, you know, I'm not saying you can't update it, because there are definitely parallels you can make, but I feel like the 80s setting is kind of like key to like the whole thing. So I hope he keeps that.
Okay. All right. So last story that I wanted to talk to you about is this movie, The Hunt for Gollum, which is the new Lord of the Rings film that Andy Serkis is directing. He's going to be reprising the role of Gollum. This movie, we've been talking about it for a little while now. We learned earlier this year that it was going to be a two-part film. I don't remember if we actually talked about that update on the podcast or not. We might have. But there was, I think Ian McKellen was the one who said on like a game show or something, or not a game show, a talk show. I actually want to see Ian McKellen on a game show now. on a talk show, he mentioned something about like, this might be a two-part movie or something. And at the time I was very distraught by that, because I thought that it indicated that the folks behind these Lord of the Rings films didn't learn the lesson of The Hobbit, what they should have learned with The Hobbit, which is like, my God, why are you trying to stretch out a pretty small story into multiple movies? That's just like the big downfall of those Hobbit films, that trilogy, in my opinion. So anyway, that's actually not what's actually happening. So Philippa Boyens, who is one of the screenwriters of the Hobbit trilogy, she also worked with Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh on the Lord of the Rings trilogy before that. She's one of the co-writers of this new anime movie that's coming out in December called The War of the Rohirrim. She said, I can tell you definitively, it isn't two films. She's talking about The Hunt for Gollum there. She said, that was a genuine misunderstanding that happened because we've begun to work conceptually on two different live action films. The first being The Hunt for Gollum, the second one still to be confirmed. And apparently the character of Gandalf is involved with a number of the ideas that they're working on, including those two projects. So she said Gandalf would potentially return for two live action films. So that must be why Ian McKellen got confused there, because they are working on multiple movies. They have no idea what that other movie is yet, but she did provide a little bit more information about what The Hunt for Gollum is actually going to be. She said it's quite an intense story, which falls after the birthday party of Bilbo and before the Mines of Moria. It is a specific chunk of incredible untold story told through the perspective of this incredible creature. So I assume you're pleased, Chris, with the idea of this being one movie instead of two. But what's your excitement level about Hunt for Gollum, especially now knowing it's just going to be one movie?
Yeah, I don't know. I love the original trilogy, the first three films. I do not love the Hobbit films, and that sort of is what gives me pause here. It feels like they lost the juice. I don't know. Like those first three films feel like lightning in a bottle sort of thing, where it's like, you can never replicate this again. You're never going to be able to go back to this. And I feel like the Hobbit movies sort of prove that, where it's like, there's, you know, you can't like recapture that magic. I would love to be proven wrong. I would love these to be good movies, but I have my doubts. You know, it just seems like I don't think they're going to be able to do this again. Like I don't, just something about those first three movies is so, I don't want to use the word real, because they're fantasy epics, but they feel real in a way those Hobbit movies do not, where everything feels like extra digital and just fake. Like, I don't know, just like, because they were made at different times too. Even though they're not, they weren't made completely, like, they weren't made like 30 years apart or anything like that. But like, when Peter Jackson made those first three movies, they were made at a time when practical effects work was a lot more prominent than it is now. And I just worry it's going to be like a bunch of digital backgrounds again. And I just, you know, it's just ugly shit, you know. Just,
yeah,
give me that, the beauty of those first three movies where everything feels sort of lived in and tactile. And
yeah,
you know, so, you know, that's sort of my biggest concern.
Yeah, the New Zealand backdrops, I mean, it can't be overstated how big of a factor those played in the success of that original trilogy. So I agree with you. I am hesitant. I hope that Andy Serkis, who has been very passionate about this character for a long time, is coming to this with some specific take that he wants to do and explore, and that it's going to be ultimately more than just a corporate edict from David Zaslav of like, tap this IP and get as much out of it as you can or whatever. So the idea that they're making this one movie instead of two is actually encouraging to me on that front. So, cause I can imagine him just being like, take every Lord of the Rings thing and stretch it out as long as possible. And like, you know, just to try to milk as much money out of it as they can. But, yeah, anyway, I'm a little bit more optimistic about this than you are, but we'll see how it goes. Speaking of the War of the Rohirrim, which is the anime movie that I mentioned, Jeremy Mathai, who writes for Slash Film, went to, I think it was New York Comic Con this past weekend, and attended a panel where I think Philippa Boyens was there and several of the filmmakers and stuff like that. And so he wrote up this thing called 8 Things Every Lord of the Rings Fan Needs to Know About War of the Rohirrim, and has a lot of updates about what happened at that panel and some of the best breakouts and stuff from there. So if you're interested in that film and looking forward to that, then check out that link in the show notes. And I think that's going to do it for today's episode. You can find more about all of the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will link to a bunch of things in the show notes. You can find them really easily there. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.